Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Victoria Phillips, and I am here with Ian Hembro. And we are here today to discuss a new book, Ralph Edwards' Rare Events, The Inside Story of a Worldwide Quest for Safer Medicine, which came out in January 2023 with Springer Press. So Ian, welcome. Tell us a bit about yourself first.
I'm a visiting scholar at Wolfson College at the Oxford Centre for Life Writing, Oxford University. So I've come to writing fairly late in life, really. I've spent most of my working life working in the housing industry in the UK.
Wonderful. So tell us about Rafe. Who and what is this book about?
Yeah. So I think I would go as far as to say I think Rafe is a great living scientist. He's 80 later this year, and he originally trained as a physician, as a medical doctor. And the book is about his whole life, but in particular, his journey into moving from general medicine into becoming a really world-leading figure in the safety of medicines and the science that's grown up around that. So the technical term for the science of making medicines as safe as they can be is called pharmacovigilance. So pharma, as in related to medicines, co, something you do collaboratively, and vigilance, being on the alert for dangers and risks and sounding the alarm if something happens. So pharmacovigilance, but medicine safety is probably an easier phrase. And in particular, he, for nearly 20 years, was the director of a center in Uppsala in Sweden, which is the World Health Organization's hub for medicine safety. So as we'll probably talk about later on, whenever anyone, pretty much anywhere in the world, reports a problem or a side effect or an adverse reaction or something to any kind of medical treatment through the national international system, which Rafe did an enormous amount to set up, that report or the data from it eventually ends up at this center in Sweden. And he led it from a very, very small team. I think there were four people there when he joined, into becoming this really sort of world-leading global hub for trying to make medicines as safe as they can be.
Interesting. It sounds like a great topic right now, particularly with what's going on in the United States with the Food and Drug Administration. So
yeah,
it'd be very interesting for readers.
And of course, the global experience of the coronavirus and COVID has sort of really put this issue right at the top of people's interests and concerns and awareness in a way that it never was before. So the very rapid development of vaccines to try and protect populations against COVID has necessarily raised a huge amount of questions and issues. And as I said, just greater attention around just how safe are medicines and depending on how they've been tested and under what conditions. So, yeah.
What has it been like to write about someone who's alive? Is this an authorized biography? Did you use oral histories? Did you allow him to read it? Did he have objections?
The answer to most of those is yes, except for the last one. So no, I mean, I worked very, very closely with Rafe on this. I mean, the original plan was that the book would be published actually by the center I mentioned, the Uppsala Monitoring Center, for various reasons. In the end, it was decided to publish it sort of privately or directly rather via Springer, who are the biggest medical publishers in the world. But no, it was very much a collaborative effort with Rafe in particular. So I spent many, many hours. He lives in Sweden, so even though he's English, he lived in Sweden for many years. So I spent many hours with him recording conversations, a fair amount of background research and reading and talking to other people. Because, I mean, I think one of the great themes of this book is the collaborative effort that goes on to create something that is truly global in its reach. So people all over the world have contributed, and there's various sort of first-hand accounts from different people within the book. But so, yes, absolutely authorized, very much a joint effort between particularly Rafe, but then, as we'll probably also talk about in a minute, I mean, one of the slightly unusual things is that after he stepped down as director of the center in Uppsala, he was actually replaced by his wife, a lady called Marie or Lindquist, Swedish pharmacologist. So that's pretty unusual for that to happen in organizations. But for a whole host of reasons, she was the right person to replace him. And she'd been one of the founding members of the center. So there's a bit of a love story in there as well, I think, in terms of their relationship. And a chap also called Bruce Hugman, another Englishman who worked in this area for many years. And he's very much the communications expert, because although we're in the realms of medical science here, communications is a massive part of this. And once again, I think the COVID experience is an example of that, is that it's all very well having the science, but unless people know about it or know what to do with that information. So the communications task of medicine safety is an enormous priority. So yeah, as well as Rafe, there's at least two other sort of key characters that crop up a lot in the book. And as I said, a whole supporting cast of people all over the world.
Well, were you able to do oral histories with all of them?
Not all directly. I mean, I spoke to a lot of people. I wasn't able to sit down with everyone. So quite a lot of it was done remotely. But yes, I collated either written or over the phone or online conversations with lots of different people from different countries. Yeah.
Was there ever a moment when you thought, oh, I wish this person were here so I could write X?
That's a very interesting question. I think the honest answer is no. I mean, inevitably, some people strike a slightly different chord, perhaps ordinarily to take you by surprise with some of the things that they say. I mean, I think one of the things that's both interesting and impressive about Rafe is that he is an incredibly forceful personality, and that's how he's been able to, you know, pretty much from scratch create this system of global drug monitoring that exists today. I mean, he really is someone who makes things happen. Unsurprisingly, you know, when you have a personality like that, occasionally he can rub people up the wrong way as well, or, you know, people perhaps, you know, don't always react to that as well. So he's made many, many friends over the world, but a few people have, you know, found him difficult or, you know, perhaps too directive in his approach. So I guess sometimes, but people were very honest, and actually, you know, he wanted them to be honest, and he would be the first to admit to, you know, his faults, as we all have. So I think there were occasions when people had some critical things to say about him, but that's part of the story, and those are in the book as well, and Rafe is very happy for them to be.
Oh, your reader does not need to be schooled in medical technology and the like, is that correct?
Absolutely so, and because I certainly wasn't. I mean, the challenge I found here was to, because I mean, some of this stuff, as we may come on to in a minute, is quite complicated data science, so artificial intelligence, neural networks, and pretty, you know, high powered stuff, which I had very little knowledge of indeed. I think my task as the author was to try and understand it enough, or to the level that I could then explain it in plain terms to an everyday reader. And we deliberately, from the start, tried to write a book that wouldn't just be about the nitty-gritty of the science, that it was a human story. And yes, something I think that people would find some resonance with, even if they're not involved in it, because, I mean, there's, what, 8 billion people almost on this planet. Virtually all of us will take medicines at some point during our lives. I mean, obviously, we take those things in the hope that they'll help us and heal us. But, and this is what Rafe and Marie in particular have devoted their lives to, I mean, we also need to be aware that those same substances can and do cause harm and can and do kill. I mean, you're from the United States, Victoria. So amongst adult deaths, deaths related to medicines is the fifth highest cause of adult deaths in the USA. And across the world, I mean, about 2.5 million people die every year from side effects or adverse reactions of some sort to medicines or medical treatments of one form or another. And we're not just talking about sort of traditional healthcare medicines here. I mean, their work at the center also spans herbal remedies, natural remedies, alternative medicines, so of which, of course, there are a vast number.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I recently about an AIDS that has almost grown.
I mean, the numbers of this are quite staggering, really. I mean, in the UK, the National Health Service in the UK in 2022 issued 1.14 billion prescriptions. So given that the UK has only got a population of about 65 million, that works out about 17 prescriptions every single person in a year. And obviously it's heavily skewed to older people and people with ongoing health conditions. So if you've got 1.14 billion prescriptions, even a 10th of 1% of some kind of problem, that would still be well over a million people. And even a 1,000th of 1%. I mean, that's still 11,500 people who are adversely affected in some way. So the numbers, when you multiply that up by the countries in the world which have much bigger populations, India, China, you know, South America, I mean, the numbers are pretty mind-boggling in terms of just how much data they are working with to spot patterns. And I'm sure many people listening to this will remember the problems that arose in the 1950s and 60s with the drug thalidomide and the birth defects that caused in because mothers would take the drug to try as a cure or to diminish the effects of morning sickness. And unfortunately, because it wasn't known that was a risk, that started to cause these birth defects. But because they were spread all across the world, and there were about 10,000 children affected by that across the world, it took a long time for people to work out what was causing these problems. And it was only an Australian doctor, actually, who finally pinpointed the cause of it. And it was that led to this global system being created, is that to try and avoid that happening again, where a drug used in good faith, it took a long time to pick up that it was having these really catastrophic health impacts on unborn children.
How much this is biography?
Yeah, we ummed and ahed really about whether this is a biography. I mean, it certainly does tell the whole of Rafe's life so far. I mean, as I said, he's 80 this year and still very much fit and active. But also it tells the life story, really, of the area of science that he worked in and Maria had worked in, and their pivotal role in driving it forward. As I said, this was a really niche area of science. You know, even if you just go back to the 1950s and 60s with the issues I mentioned with thalidomide, and it's really grown over that last sort of 60, 70 years or so. And Rafe has been an absolutely world-leading figure in making that happen, in particular in turning it into a global effort. I mean, originally, it tended just to be developed nations that were working on this, but his achievement in creating systems that can detect problems in just about every country on Earth. I mean, there's only about a couple of dozen countries that are not now members of the World Health Organization's program for drug monitoring. So his and other people's success in driving this, you know, throughout the world is a fantastic story, actually, and a real testament to his energy and the abilities of other people. So he studied at University of Birmingham Medical School, had various hospital jobs in the UK, and then he rather bravely went off to work in what was then Rhodesia, pretty much at the height of the Bush War there and the independence. And he was there when Rhodesia became independent and was obviously renamed Zimbabwe. And from there, never a man to stand still in life, he went right off the other side of the world to work in New Zealand for a number of years, where they, to this day, have a very, very well-developed and very integrated approach to any kind of poisons, including medicines. And then from New Zealand to Sweden, where he met Marie, and as I said, eventually they married, and then between them led the organization for 30 years.
So tell me about her.
Marie, yeah. So I mean this in the nicest possible way, very Swedish, so tall, elegant, sharp as a tack intellectually, very, very focused person. I mean, very different person to Rafe, because I said earlier on that Rafe is a sort of very driven person, and you meet Marie and she's much sort of quieter and calmer, and yet still absolutely is determined. So between them, they make a very powerful couple, actually. And still are. I mean, even though they're both retired from their professional jobs at the center, they're still very, very active in different aspects, editing journals, speaking at conferences. So they remain, you know, big figures in this area. And as I said, they are a terrific foil for each other. So as I said, Marie trained as a pharmacologist, and I think slightly reluctantly actually became an organizational leader. I don't think it was something she really thought was her skill set, but she turned into a very, very effective leader in her own right in a completely different way to Rafe. I mean, whereas Rafe is someone who will tackle things head on and just keep cracking away at them, Marie's a sort of rather sort of more cool operator who will sort of go around the sides of problems and influence in a quieter way and yet still absolutely get things done. So as I said, they're a formidable duo between them.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So out of all of those documents, what part of the book stands out most for you? What's the key moment?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think some of the things we've already talked about, I mean, this is a genuinely global achievement that he and other people are involved in, and those are rare. There aren't many, and now particularly even less so than before. I mean, if you go back to things like, I don't know, the space race and so on, there is elements of global either competition or cooperation, but things that have a genuinely global reach are pretty rare, and this is definitely one of them. There's a gripping tale in one of the chapters where Rafe had become aware that a anti-malaria drug, the short version of which was called Lapdap, was being marketed in Africa, in various countries in Africa. And he started sort of querying how, and it was particularly used for children against malaria, he started querying how the drug company had got informed consent for the trials of this drug. And the more he dug into this, the more alarmed he became that actually there was not proper provisions in place for informed consent, and that the numbers of people taking the drug just could not match up with, you know, proper sort of protocols. So he and a Danish investigative journalist took themselves off to Kenya to just try and personally to track this down. So it almost turns into this sort of espionage type story. And it's uncanny. I don't know if you've ever read or seen the film of a book by John le Carré called The Constant Gardener. It is almost exactly that story of, you know, pretty, should we say, questionable practices going on in developing countries by pharmaceutical companies, and then the kind of risks and problems that occurs. So him and Mats, the Danish journalist, spent time in Kenya really just trying to track down examples of what was going on. So yeah, it does read like a spy thriller almost. So for me, that is, in terms of just pure storytelling, a standout thing. And it says a lot about Rafe, I think, that he's not someone just to sit in his office and write papers about this stuff. He got on a plane and took himself off to Kenya to try and track this down. And so it speaks a lot, I think, of his kind of energy and commitment.
You know, if you had three takeaways that you would want all your readers to come away with, what would they be?
It was interesting, actually, Victoria. Quite recently, I was just doing a short presentation about this book at a local writers group, and there were two kind of reactions, really. I mean, people were interested to know that this monitoring system exists, and obviously I think particularly in the wake of their experiences through COVID, people were sort of saying, you know, why don't we know this stuff, why don't we know that this system exists or what to do? So I think the first takeaway would be, you know, if you are about to take or have been taking any kind of medicine or any medical treatment or any supplements, it's important to know what it is you're taking. I mean, not that all of us would understand the chemical makeup of substances, but at least to be clear about what it is you're actually putting inside yourself, and why that happens. And as you said earlier on, what the correct dose and regularity and indeed course of treatment is as well. Because I mean, I think people possibly myself included, are a bit blasé about that. You know, what's the difference between one paracetamol and two? Well, quite a lot. So observing those things. And of course, there is pretty much limitless potential for anything we consume, whether it's food or medicine, to interact with other things in our body. So there can be things in our diet, in our physiological makeup, in our environment, that can interact in some way. So, and once again, the COVID is a great example of that. Billions of people have taken those vaccines. Only a certain number of them have been affected by it. And it's that sort of disposition that people have that is changing all the time. So I think just to be aware, really, of, for a start, there is no medicine that is 100% safe or effective, and that there is always the potential for either the medicine itself or it interacting in some way to cause you harm. And really most important is, if that happens, how important it is to report it. And you can either do that direct. I mean, most countries have a direct online reporting system now. So in the UK, it's called the Yellow Card system. So there's a Yellow Card app you can have on your phone to report it. Or you can report via your physician. So if it's your, consultant or general practitioner who has prescribed something, you can report it via them. I mean, the rough estimate, we can't be sure, of course, the rough estimate is that probably only about 5% of adverse reactions get reported. So if you go back to the numbers I talked about earlier on, about 2.5 million people, that's only the known ones. So the real incidence of medicine-related harm is probably much, much greater. So it is really important. And I think over time, then that should be the great aim of humanity, actually, is if we are going to continue using medicines in the way we do, that we need to take on board the responsibility to say when something goes wrong with them. And I think the final thing, I've touched on this already, is a hopeful message, actually, because I do think this is a great example of what can be achieved when nations really do work together. Because if you take, for example, the comparison with how international cooperation is going on climate change at the moment, I mean, that's a pretty patchy and gradual process, whereas by comparison, the speed at which this global system was put in place to try and prevent things like the thalidomide problems happening again was remarkably quick. It happened, you know, within a decade or so from a standing start. So I think it is a great example of what really can be achieved when you have that kind of drive and leadership and common ground that this is something we all need to work together on. If I can be permitted another takeaway, I think that is another take or learning point for me in writing this book, is just how incredibly finely judged some of these decisions are, because as you say, no announcement around the safety of a drug is consequence free. So the moment you say there is a problem with this drug, then inevitably not only does that affect people's use of it, but it also then starts to affect the drug company's, you know, operating systems, which means that they may be better or able or less able to develop new drugs. So it's a really fine judgments involved in it, and no guarantee that you'll get them right. Rafe and Marie are now officially retired, but as I said, they absolutely remain very much involved in these areas. I mean, a project which they put a lot of time into is run from Oslo, is called Cause Health, and it's all about trying to understand the causality behind adverse reactions. Is that some people will be more disposed to being affected by medical treatments than others, and it's about understanding what those variables are, right down to the individual, and indeed, you know, how that individual will change over time. So somebody's disposition towards medical problems when they're 15 will be different to when they're 50. And that actually takes you more into philosophy than medical science. So there's some areas of this which are very, very advanced thinking. And as I said, also particularly around data science as well. So in many ways, the work that Rafe and his colleagues in Sweden did were absolutely in the front of big data and artificial intelligence. And clearly that has the potential now to revolutionize healthcare in terms of how predictive systems are used.
Where do you think the science of medicine safety is going now, and where do you think it will be going?
Some of the things, I mean, particularly artificial intelligence, we've already mentioned. I mean, I think some of the really exciting stuff, and I'm certainly no expert to talk about it, but I'm aware of it, is in materials, particularly nanotechnology scale materials. So, I mean, once again, some people may remember in the 1960s, there was a film made, I think it was called The Fantastic Voyage, where a team of scientists were shrunk to the size of a blood cell in a little submarine and sent off around someone's body. I mean, that is already effectively happening. Not little submarines, but I mean, you know, nanotechnology is being used to send interventions into people's bodies now. And obviously, as new materials are developed to take the place of some of the organic materials that have previously been used in medicines, then I think that does have some really interesting potential. Once again, though, there will be risks attached to that. So if you are going to start putting nano atom sized stuff into people's bodies, there will be an effect of some sort. So I think that could be the sort of next whole sort of realm, really, for pharmacovigilance, is tracking and understanding the impact of that over time as well, because we just don't know at the moment. We know it's possible to do it, but there's not enough data at the moment to see what the long-term effects of that might be.
So what are some of the lessons for science, for industry, and society?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to this point about making change again, really. I mean, Rafe is very honest and clear about just how incredibly frustrating he has found bureaucracy in all its forms. So right from his early days working in hospitals where, you know, you get this kind of hierarchical tier of decision making, up to and including when he's working as part of and with the World Health Organization, bureaucracies, for all the things that they achieve, do carry with them a fair degree of inertia. So I think there's a lesson in this book for how to deal with that, some ways in which to deal with it. I'm not sure there's a perfect answer, but that bureaucracy can be, I wouldn't say overcome, but it can be turned to advantage, and there are techniques that work better than ever. And as I said, the comparison between the leadership and influencing styles of Rafe and Marie are a great case study in that, is that Marie was absolutely able to achieve some things that Rafe wasn't through her different style. So I think there's a real theme that runs right through the book about how do you make change, and particularly where there are either vested interests stacked up against you or people who are at least or at best, you know, uncooperative or perhaps unconvinced that they want to make the change. So I think that's the theme that runs through the book.
That's great. So tell me about who you rely on as you're writing. You recently showed me a publicity picture with a group of you. What's your process? Do you workshop your work? Do you not workshop your work? When do you share? When do you write?
I suppose my practice has been developing in quite recently, Victoria. I guess I tended in the past to be quite a sort of solo writer. I mean, over the last few years, and particularly through being involved with the Oxford Centre for Life Writing at the University of Oxford, I mean, I really have come to value the collaborative aspect of writing and sharing and giving and receiving open critical feedback at every stage. And it's extraordinary how different sets of eyes can look onto work and just see something different in it, or see opportunities that perhaps you hadn't seen yourself, and even connections you hadn't seen yourself. So I very much value and enjoy both sides, actually, both the giving and receiving of feedback around writing.
So what next? What are you working on?
Because on the very first time I was in Uppsala in Sweden to meet Rafe, literally the first day, we went out for a walk at lunchtime. And as we were walking down the main street in Uppsala, he pointed across to an older building and he said, "That's where Professor Celsius used to work." So I said, "Oh, what you mean Celsius as in temperature scale?" And he said, "Yes." And so that's what I'm now doing. I'm writing a biography of Professor Anders Celsius, who lived in the 18th century, the man who gave us the temperature scale that most of the world uses. And obviously also that scale is what now frames the whole debate around climate change, and this idea that we're going to try and contain the increase in average temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels. So that's been a really nice spin-off, and I'm actually going over to Sweden again quite soon to sort of complete my research on that, go and visit some more of the places where Celsius worked. And then, I mean, once again, I've got no real background in medical matters, but I mean, an area I am interested in is the whole, and once again, current debate around assisted and voluntary dying. And I am hoping to do a piece of work around the sort of working title of it is "The Words We Need to Die," because I think, I mean, obviously some countries do have more progressive laws around voluntary and assisted dying. And I think as that becomes more widespread, and I think it is inexorable that it will, in some ways, changing the law is the easy bit. I think the kind of social attitudes and the behaviors and the permissions that we bring to how we deal with that personally and within families and as collectives, that is going to be a significant issue. So yeah, I'm interested in doing some work around, as I said, just how we talk about, broker, deal with, communicate around assisted dying. So yeah, that's the next project, I think.
That's great. It sounds like a really worthwhile project. Do you ever think about going back to housing issues?
I still do work in housing, and actually one of the sort of, if there is a link between all this at different stages of my life and career, I mean, the kind of housing I've been involved in, sort of social housing, particularly for people on low incomes who for whatever reason wouldn't be able to afford to buy or rent at market rates. I mean, the origins of that movement were absolutely health-based. So particularly around cholera epidemics, it was to try and provide better living conditions. That was a public health initiative originally. So there is a link there which almost goes full circle, because I mean, right now, once again, in the UK particularly, there's a lot of concern about how some of the sort of poorer quality or more affordable homes in the country have been allowed. The conditions have deteriorated as poverty has increased. So it's almost come full circle now with people's health and their relationship to their home being, you know, back very much in the picture.
Well, I think that's a wonderful place to end, back full circle from housing to health. And it sounds like you've got some wonderful projects ahead of you. And I look forward to interviewing you about Celsius.
We'll make a date for that, Victoria. That would be lovely. And thank you for your support that you've given through that project as well. So, that's been great to talk to you about it. And you've asked some very penetrating questions there, which do go to the heart of it. So thank you.
Thank you so much.